Welcome to another edition of San Luis Valley Voices, a production of SL Voices, your voice in the San Luis Valley. Without further ado, enjoy the program.
Sponsorship of this program was provided by...
The San Luis Valley Seed Exchange is an exciting and informative annual event that connects gardeners, farmers, seed producers, and collectors with each other and with the community. The 10th Annual Seed Exchange will bring our community together over local food, sustainable agriculture, high-altitude seeds and gardening, herbalism, and garden maintenance. The fantastic people at Joyful Journey consider it a privilege to provide a beautiful place complete with hot springs and snow-capped mountain views for this incredible event. Community members from all over the valley gather to exchange and share their knowledge and experience in our unique San Luis Valley. This year, the Seed Exchange is on Saturday, March 7th, from 10 a.m. till 5 p.m. in the Event Center at Joyful Journey Hot Springs Spa. The SLV Seed Exchange generously donates all proceeds to nonprofit organizations that are committed to sustainability and education. In previous years, this has gone to both the Mountain Valley Community Garden and the Moffitt School Greenhouse Project. There will be knowledgeable speakers and vendor booths that focus on sustainability, education, seeds, local handmade products, and permaculture. You'll meet wonderful people, make valuable connections, and create relationships with like-minded and common goal-oriented people. In addition, the San Luis Valley Seed Exchange is excited to announce their inaugural harvest celebration in October, which will also be held at the Event Center at Joyful Journey Hot Springs Spa, and will focus on end-of-the-season gardening, including harvesting, preserving, and seed saving. More details to come. As a sponsor, your business or organization helps fund the event expenses, including space rentals, advertising, and donations. In gratitude, your business will be promoted in various ways, including being linked on the podcast page, the SLV Seed Exchange website, event program, posters, banners, and more. With all the benefits of being a sponsor, you'll want to reach out soon to the friendly folks at Joyful Journey so they can provide you with sponsor benefit information. Be sure and tell your friends and associates about this tremendous sponsorship opportunity. Learn more through the Seed Exchange website, slvseedexchange.com, that's slvseedexchange.com, or call Joyful Journey Hot Springs at 719-256-4328, that's 719-256-4328, or for more information, email Joyful Journey at marketing@jjhotsprings.com, that's marketing@jjhotsprings.com. The 10th Annual SLV Seed Exchange, hosted by Joyful Journey Hot Springs Spa on Saturday, March 7th. Proud sponsor of this second installment of the Mysterious San Luis Valley podcast with paranormal researcher Christopher O'Brien.
Christopher O'Brien spent over a decade in the San Luis Valley learning about and investigating over 1,000 paranormal events, working with law enforcement, former military, ranchers, and an extensive network of sky watchers. He documented what may have been the most intense wave of unexplained activity ever seen in a single region of North America. That region, located in south central Colorado and north central New Mexico, is known as the San Luis Valley. His time, effort, and experiences resulted in a Mysterious Valley book trilogy and includes The Mysterious Valley, Enter the Valley, and Secrets of the Mysterious Valley, one of the largest databases of unusual activity in a single geographic region, is a direct result of his field investigations of UFO reports, unexplained livestock deaths, haunted sites, Native American legends, cryptozoology, and folklore found in the world's largest alpine valley. This database is available for access by all on his website, ourstrangeplanet.com. Christopher O'Brien was kind enough to spend an entire day with SL Voices to tell his stories, as well as stories shared with him by various people in the San Luis Valley. We gladly present this multi-part podcast series to our audience to inform, entertain, and enlighten. Enjoy!
I'm Adam, and we're here with Martha, and UFO researcher, amongst other things, Christopher O'Brien. This is part two of our multi-part podcast series, and we're going to touch on UFOs, balls of light, rods, and many, many more things. Welcome back to the SL Voices studio, Christopher. We appreciate you joining us.
Good to be back.
You were in the middle of telling us a story about a yellow helicopter during our first podcast. So what is the conclusion to this?
Well, just to recap a little bit on the story, my first case was out in Moffett, Colorado, 13 years after the fact. I interviewed the Sutherland family, and they talked about a yellow helicopter that they tied into the mutilation of their bull. And it was an ancient UH-47, a whirly bird that only had a 90-mile range. So it couldn't even fly up from Alamos Airport and back because it was over 90 miles. They went out and searched their pasture where they felt this thing had landed. And of course, that's where they found their bull. Now, this is June 1980. I'm interviewing, scribbling all my notes and everything in a spiral notebook. I thanked them and asked if I could take the skull. We went out and saw the site. The animal was still lying there, just all desiccated in the desert. And I grabbed the skull, took it home, and painted it. So I went home, and the next morning I was sitting, in my bathrobe and a cup of coffee, typing up my notes, from the day before. And I hear this thump, 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 thump sound. And I looked out my window, and a yellow UH-47 flew over my house.
Wow.
I have four other witnesses. My neighbor saw it. Isidore saw it. Brisa saw it. I'm trying to remember who else. There was one other person that saw it. It's like Bear Rabbit in The Tar Baby. I kissed the tar baby, and it still stuck to my face. That was such a pivotal thing for me to be involved in such a inexplicable synchronistic event like that. I instantly knew that something way more involved than just aliens coming from another planet to mutilate our cattle and fly around with impunity in our airspace. I knew something way more involved and complicated was going on instantly. And that really was a key moment, just like my sighting experience as a young boy. That event solidified my absolute fascination with the subject matter and really spurred me on to do the thousands of interviews that I've done and do all the TV shows, all the radio shows, all the podcasts, and try to get the word out about these types of events and give people information about my personal work. And it also spurred me on to really write that first book, The Mysterious Valley. I've written three books about my work there in the valley, The Mysterious Valley, Enter the Valley, and Secrets of the Mysterious Valley. I'm very proud of those books. I really tried my hardest to illustrate what it's like to start out being a novice and then giving myself rules of investigation for my readers to hold me to it, and then allow the reader to sort of experience my educational process about these subjects as I'm experiencing them. And I wrote it that way for a very specific purpose, and that is to inspire other people who are locals in their environment to go out and do this kind of work that needs to be done in their neck of the woods. I've really been gratified by some of the response that I've gotten to my books. And I do have quite a number of fans out there. And I really feel that these subjects are now out of the closet. And it's really important for people to be properly trained on how to deal with such deep emotional subjects to experiencers. People that experience this kind of activity, it's triggering something deep within their psyche. And I think it touches a collective point that each individual has. We're all connected on a deep archetypal level, the collective unconscious, if you will. And this type of experience triggers certain things in a person's subconscious. And I think it's very, very important to respect that and to tread lightly when doing this type of investigative work. Oftentimes, people say, what are you? And if I've just had a particularly difficult case, I often find myself saying that I'm a paranormal shrink. if you've had a big, burly cattle rancher crying on your shoulder because they came and mutilated his best breeding cow, it's hard not to be, touched by that. And I really feel that I have a responsibility to do a good job by these people.
Is it ufology, ufoology? How is that pronounced?
Ufology. Well, I tell all the TV shows, don't you dare call me a ufologist. I don't want to be lumped in with those folks. It's too fractious. Actually, I consider myself an anomalist or just a simple investigative journalist who tries to do things as scientifically as I possibly can as an uncredentialed amateur.
On the topic or subject of ufology, let's touch on some of these. I'm sure you've experienced them or have research in them. Balls of light, what exactly are those?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I don't think anybody can really give a solid, specific answer. There in the valley, I think that there are natural phenomena that are misconstrued and misidentified as strange phenomena. And I do think we have areas there around the sand dunes, around the Baca Ranch, where we have fluorescing methane, literal swamp gas, if you will. That was obviously one of the buzzwords back in the 60s when the head scientific advisor for Project Blue Book, which was the Air Force's investigation into UFOs, tried to palm off one sighting event in Michigan in 1966 as being swamp gas. And he could have been right, because there was a swamp back there and there was some gas that would occasionally fluoresce if the conditions were right. Ball lightning can fool people, although I think it's pretty rare. I think we have something there in the valley that I call cheap fireworks, and I'm sure anybody in the valley who's been there long enough has seen what look like giant bottle rockets fizzling out. They're not meteors or meteorites. I've actually seen them below me. I was at 9,000 feet. This thing arched out over Spanish Creek, which would have been about 1,500 feet below me, and there was a uniform overcast sky. So I was not looking at a shooting star or meteor. I was looking at one of these cheap fireworks. And these things tend to show up just prior to an upwelling of UFO activity. And then you start to see them again when the wave of UFO activity is about ready to end. These things kind of are seen at the beginning and the end of a UFO wave. For some reason, I've yet to figure out what the exact correlation is. One thing I must tell your listeners, I have probably the largest database of unusual events from a single geographic region anywhere. And it's online. I don't charge for it. If you're interested in seeing all the reports that have 10 points of data, date, time, location, the witness name or lack of a name if they want to be anonymous, whether the media got involved, whether an official report was made, who the investigator was. If I have that date, time, location, and duration, if I have that information, it goes into my database. I'm up around 1,000 events right now. I urge everyone, if you're interested, to get a real good idea of how much running around I did back in the 90s when things are really hot and heavy. That's a good place to start. So anyway, balls of light, they can come in all different sizes. They can come in all different colors. The smallest ones tend to be real ruby red, which they're about the size of a baseball. The medium ones, which are between softball and volleyball size, are most often reported as orange or reddish. We also sometimes have small blue balls that are around softball sized. I've seen all of these on numerous occasions. We also have the white ones tend to be larger. And they tend to be further away. I've seen orange ones that are quite large. We saw two that went down one after another down the entire length of the valley from my roof up in the chalets there in the Baca Grande. They were about the size of a garage, maybe, or a car. They're quite large. So balls of light are probably the second most common thing that's seen there. The most common would be the silver spheres.
Now, you are still collecting information at this point. So if someone does see something, how do they get that to you?
Well, they can contact me either by email. Some people still are following my work. You can contact me through my website as well, ourstrangeplanet.com. If you do see something, we'd like to know. We do have the UFODAP San Luis Valley monitoring system that's in the process of being installed there. I have one camera up, and we're going to put a second and third camera and a multi-sensor package, which has a magnetometer, gravitometer, and other scientific measuring equipment, an EM natural tri-field meter. We're going to do an acoustic PZM acoustic device, a microphone to pick up low, extremely low frequencies, which are associated with these sightings. We're going to have these things set up around the country and hopefully then ultimately around the world in hotspot locations.
You're calling this the SLV Canberra Project. What are you intending to accomplish with all of this?
First of all, we're going to have a central clearinghouse of verified triangulated sighting events. Most of the time that you see some footage, it's online. About 90 to 95% of it is hoaxed or a natural phenomenon that's misidentified, whether it's insects flying by out of focus, weird looking clouds, any number of, you know, CGI type effects. If it looks too good to be true, chances are it is. That's my rule of thumb. So what we're doing is we want to get footage of a craft flying by from at least two cameras and also record any changes in the Earth's gravity, any changes in the magnetic field. And if we can replicate that data, we have kind of the holy grail of science. We've created a hypothesis that this phenomenon is real. And with that kind of data that's, you know, duplicated, then we can get an optical physicist or some other credentialed scientist who co-write an author a scientific paper for peer review.
Are you looking for support for this? Can other people become involved with you?
Yeah, we could use all the help we can get. We are selling these systems. They're just over the cost. We're basically selling them at cost, plus shipping and handling, basically, and a little bit for the fabrication of the enclosures for the scientific instruments. For $450, you can have your own system. The full-blown top-of-the-line system is about $2,500, which is amazing. I mean, it would have been $1 million plus back in the 70s or 80s. The cost of technology has become smaller and cheaper and better.
What would be a prime location for someone if they were considering putting one of these up?
Well, anywhere in the valley, especially an area that's up off the valley floor. It would be nice to have somebody in the north end of the valley around the Villa Grove area have a couple of these cameras set up. It would be nice to be on top of San Antone Mountain. These cameras have, and the scientific instruments are in environmentally protected enclosures. So they're good from 30 to 40 below all the way up to 120 degrees. So the only thing that would be an issue is the ice collecting on them. I would love to have cameras anywhere, the Del Norte area, South Fork, up in Creed. You know, anywhere in the valley would be wonderful. And then down into the Taos area and the Chama River Valley would be a great area. Over by La Magna Pass would be a great area. There's areas like around Poncha. There are areas that seem to have more activity, and they tend to be areas where people don't live. It's almost like oftentimes these things have, these aerial craft have pathways that are in between areas where there's lots of houses. For instance, there's a pathway that goes like the Marshall Pass area over there by Poncha. And what's that lake up there, that Lake Have?
O'Haver.
O'Haver, yeah, that area, just north of Bonanza. That would be a great place to have a camera set up. The Arkansas River Valley, South Park, over in Howard, over in Westcliff, Ferrisita. It'd be great to have somebody in Malachite, just over the hill. And Red Wing, there's tons of places that these setups could be put in. And as long as you got power and the internet, that's what's important. We do have solar setups as well, so that if you don't have power, but you have internet, you can have these systems set up. We do have portable ones that don't need power.
Christopher, what about rods? What are those all about?
Well, it depends.
We actually have just a funny little story about our experience with rods, and maybe you can shed some light on that. We were driving home one night, and we lived on the mountains around between Villa Grove and Bonanza. We were going up the hill, and these two rod-shaped, shiny objects darted across in front of our windshield. And Adam looked over at me, and he said, "Honey, did you see that?" And I looked at him, and I said, "Not if you didn't." That was our experience with rods. So I know there's something there.
Those
I just don't know
ones.
What it was.
Ones. The silver ones are the real ones.
Well, it was very, very fast. They were probably at a 45-degree angle to the ground, headed down. They were there and gone in a matter of 2 seconds or less. Really stunned both of us. We weren't sure what to make of it.
Yeah, those are the real ones, the silver ones. Did they have appendages, or were they just like rods, like thin metal rods?
No, just thin metal, okay. Metal rods and small. They weren't huge.
The guy who came up with this whole idea of rods, his name is Jose Escamilla. Unfortunately, we lost him a couple years ago. He noticed these strange things that would show up on his video camera. They looked like something that you would see in the ocean. They had little appendages sticking off that would almost flutter. Of course, immediately the detractors came out and said, "Well, what you got there is an insect that's flying close to the camera and it's out of focus. And what you're seeing, those legs, are an artifact for the interlacing of digital video." And similar to the way you can pick up these orbs with a digital camera at night with a flash as being dust particulate in the air that's out of focus close to the camera. It's a similar type situation. However, we've come up with a foolproof way to decide and analyze these things to determine if they're real rods or if they're an artifact. And that is the number of appendages. If there is an odd number of appendages, it's a real object. If there's an even number of appendages, it's an artifact. So anybody that gets these things on their video cameras, count how many appendages. If they're offset and there's an odd number of them, you've caught a real bona fide rod. If there's an even number, again, you've got an artifact on your hand. I have seen incredible footage of rods over the years. It's kind of not been as popular a subject, I think, in the last few years as it was in the 90s and early 2000s. But I still occasionally get people showing me footage, asking me what I think.
What are they considered?
You know, we don't know. Just like all these objects, we really don't know. I have a feeling that there could be some unidentified kind of life form. They seem biological to me, many of them. The silver ones, not necessarily. They seem to be more like technology. But many of these rods, they look like sky creatures. There was an investigator in the 60s and 70s named Trevor James Constable, a very, very interesting guy. And he would use infrared film and catch huge objects, or what he called sky critters in the air that you could only see on infrared. He thought that these things were actual biological creatures that lived in the sky. And I know it sounds a little sci-fi sounding, but there may be something to that. You know, we may not have identified and been able to define a whole class of life forms on this planet that actually lives in the sky. So, you know, you can't rule anything out. You can't rule anything in. You have to have an open mind. You know, a mind is like a parachute. It only works when it's open.
That makes a lot of sense. You have to consider, too, they're still finding creatures down in the ocean. They're still finding insects that we knew nothing about. So the possibility of something in the sky, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I think so, because they may live in a different time frame than we do. They may live in compressed time. They may be operating in a much faster rate of reality than we are. We might be like a sloth trying to crawl across a road, as opposed to them, they're like bumblebees flying around or something. You have to be open-minded. You can't factor anything in. You can't factor anything out in this realm. I learned that a long time ago when I first got started. You know, if you believe in one thing and not another, you've cut yourself off from half the potential answers that are out there. Because if you believe in one thing, then that means you don't believe in something else. So that's why you never see in my books the word believe or belief, unless I'm talking about other people. People say, well, what do you believe? And I say, I don't believe any of this stuff, you know, but I'm open-minded to consider all possibilities.
Chris, we asked some of our followers to give us their questions, and I'm going to just toss one out here to you. This is from James and Blanca, and he asks if you think that Snippy the cow and other cattle mutilations are actually extraterrestrials. If not, how do you explain what has happened?
Well, Snippy is considered the first cattle mutilation, so I understand the mistake there, but Snippy was actually a horse. Snippy was actually named Lady. Lady's sire, who didn't get mutilated, was named Snippy, but Snippy sounded more appropriate. So when the press got the two names mixed up, the name stuck and Lady became Snippy. No, I do not think that extraterrestrials are coming many light years to harvest parts for udder souffle, lip and eye stew. It's just, to me, it just absolutely is ludicrous. If they were actually coming here, and the common theme is, they have a dying race, and they're coming here to get genetic material to hybridize their dying race. Because cattle hemoglobin is a virtual match to human hemoglobin, they use the blood to either as a food source or as a way to genetically modify their dying race and strengthen it. That's ludicrous. If they wanted genetic material from cattle, all they'd have to do is break into an abattoir or a slaughterhouse, and there's big vats of genetic material all there, and they wouldn't have to go sneaking around in pastures and grabbing the body parts from poor, unsuspecting animals. They could just break into a slaughterhouse. So I think that out of all the potential explanations as to who's involved and or what's involved, the alien hypothesis is the least tenable and probably the least likely explanation. That's just my own personal opinion. I think that the reason why the animals are left there and why the animals aren't taken from feedlots, let's say, there's only been one case associated with a feedlot, to my knowledge, for instance. It's pretty obvious to me and to other investigators that it's not the cow in particular that's important. It's where the cow is in the environment. I think that's a real major clue. I think we're dealing with some form of environmental monitoring. You know, I think the government's involved. I think that there's, at the core of this, there may be a high, strange, supernatural predator that's involved that may be responsible for our ancient practice of animal sacrifice. I think that there is a blood-based, ritualized element to this whole thing, but the majority of cases, I feel, are done to monitor the potential spread of mad cow disease in the food chain. I think the beef industry could be involved. I think some clandestine element of the Centers for Disease Control or the National Institute of Health or some quasi-medical organization in concert with the cattle industry may, you know, big beef may be involved. Let's not forget, the beef industry is the largest lobby in this country with the most power that you never hear about, right? Unless you're Oprah and you'd say on your show you're not going to eat a hamburger again and you get sued for $2 billion the following day. The beef industry likes to keep out of sight. They don't like people talking about them. It's the largest income producer in agriculture. They have tremendous political clout in the West, especially. I think that there's enough evidence to suggest that there's a clandestine effort underway to monitor the spread of mad cow disease. That would be the ultimate scourge in the beef-eating West. Cattle mutilations only happen in Christian countries, for instance. That's why I wrote a 600-page book to look at all these things and to look at all the various explanations that have been proposed over the years. My basic one-line answer as to who's involved is there's multiple groups involved with multiple agendas, and they're all overlapping their particular agenda on the others to hide their activities. I'll stand behind that until the cows don't come home.
Okay, another question, Christopher. Desiree in Alamosa asked, what are your thoughts about the existence of ETs?
There are quadrillions of planets out there, and that's just 1% of what's really there. Obviously, there's got to be some sort of life out there. We can't be the only life form in the universe. I think that they've already discovered evidence of life on Mars, for instance. There's a lot of interesting smoking gun evidence to suggest that Mars may have even had advanced life on it. So I do feel that, obviously, that there are ETs out there. But when you ask, are they coming to this backward little primitive, violent, misogynist, patriarchal planet? I don't think so. I think that there's probably a warning sign out in the cosmos saying, you know, detour around this particular planet because these intelligent apes are dangerous. And I think, you know, when people say, well, you believe in aliens, I say, well, wait a minute. How do you know that we're not the aliens and they're more terrestrial than we are? What if we were brought here? What if hominids actually are not from here? You could look at things, you know, bass backwards if you want, and it would make as much sense. I think the reason why UFOs showed up en masse in large groups, flying in formation in the mid-40s, was because we put them in jeopardy when we started popping off nuclear weapons. And that they've lived here longer than we have, and we were putting them in harm's way. So I don't think that they're coming here. I think we're dealing with something more homespun. I think we're dealing with other tenants in the building.
What would those other tenants be?
Your guess is as good as mine. I think they live in compressed time. I think they have access to, they have dimensional capability. I think they can pop in and pop out. I think they're tied to many, if not most, paranormal phenomena. I think are all somehow linked. I think that there's a concerted effort by certain elements of the government to hide information from the American people and other governments hiding information from their populations for the simple reason is they're not in control of the situation. And the last thing the government will ever do is admit they're not in control because that's their job, to be in control. And if they can't be in control, they will try to steer the narrative. And that's why we saw, I think, finally, a year ago, December in 2017, the government allowing the footage from the USS Nimitz and the information from the F-16 or the F-18 pilots, rather, to come out to get ahead of the subject. Because basically what these guys were filming was probably classified American aerial technology. To have everybody think that it's UFOs, now they have a gotcha. They can come out and say, well, look at what it really was. And when they do that, then I'll be vindicated here. But I don't think that the government is ever going to come clean because most of the secret information about these craft and the technology is probably being kept in the private sector away from Freedom of Information Act requests.
I'm not so sure that we could actually handle that information if they did release it.
I don't think the baby boomer generation could handle it. I think the Gen X's and millennials, I mean, it's no big deal to them. Ask any 25-year-old if aliens exist. They look at you and go, what a dumb question. Of course they do. I mean, they're totally programmed by all this stuff already. It's the baby boomers remembering the contactees and George Adamski and Donald Keough and all the guys in the 50s and early 60s. They're the ones that can't handle it. I really have a sense we're seeing the birth of a new religion. Belief in UFOs is supplanting, I think, in the West, is supplanting outmoded belief structures in terms of religion. I think that we're seeing the birth of new belief systems.
So it's time for you, Christopher, to please tell us another partial story and let us look forward to podcast 3.
Many of your listeners who lived in the Valley back in 92, 93, 94 might remember December of 94, we had a flurry of Bigfoot reports down in Conejos County. And at the time, the police chief of Antonito was Joe Taylor, Jr. And his dad was, I think, a deputy at that point, or was still associated with the town police force. I got a call from them and they said, hey, you know, we had this really cool report of something going on. My nephew called and she said, you guys got to come down here. You're not going to believe what I found. And so, you know, we're talking right around Christmas time in the San Luis Valley. I mean, it was well below zero that night. She said that the prior night, she'd stuck her dog out of the yard and didn't want him in the yard. And he was running around outside. And she heard something really big run by, like boom, 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 boom. Something, she said, bipedal, but really heavy. She could tell it was something massive. And then she heard, I think it was a Rottweiler, a big dog that she had. She heard him yelp. And she like, oh, what the hell's going on? So she went outside and her dog was sitting there shaking like a leaf inside the fence in her yard. And she had it like a cyclone fence, if I remember correctly, around her house. And there's no way the dog could have gotten in. So she went, that's weird. I could have sworn I put him outside. Yeah, I put him outside the fence. So she put him out again. And she went and sat down and started, you know, I think she was watching TV or something. And then about 15, 20 minutes later, she heard boom, 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 running back the other way. And she heard her dog yelp again. And of course, you know, what happened? She went outside and her dog was sitting there just freaked out, shaking inside her yard. So she got a little kind of scared at this point. And so if I remember correctly, she brought the dog inside and she didn't think anything of it. But she really was impressed the next morning when she went out for a walk and had an amazing experience, which we will talk about in the next episode.
Awesome. Look forward to it.
Oh, that's almost mean.
That's great. Look forward to the next one. Thank you, Christopher.
Christopher O'Brien's latest book, Stalking the Herd, is being called one of the most important books ever written, examining our relationship with cattle and how this has manifested into the modern cattle mutilation mystery. Visit his website, OurStrangePlanet.com, for so much more information, as well as purchasing his books and DVDs. Also, visit his website, UFODAP.com. That's UFODAP.com, to learn more about his camera project, helping to capture events all across the nation. SL Voices would like to thank Christopher O'Brien and his podcast sponsors for making this special multi-part series possible.
Sponsorship of this program was provided by...
The San Luis Valley Seed Exchange is an exciting and informative annual event that connects gardeners, farmers, seed producers, and collectors with each other and with the community. The 10th annual Seed Exchange will bring our community together over local food, sustainable agriculture, high-altitude seeds and gardening, herbalism, and garden maintenance. The fantastic people at Joyful Journey consider it a privilege to provide a beautiful place complete with hot springs and snow-capped mountain views for this incredible event. Community members from all over the valley gather to exchange and share their knowledge and experience in our unique San Luis Valley. This year, the Seed Exchange is on Saturday, March 7th from 10 a.m. till 5 p.m. in the Event Center at Joyful Journey Hot Springs Spa. The SLV Seed Exchange generously donates all proceeds to nonprofit organizations that are committed to sustainability and education. In previous years, this has gone to both the Mountain Valley Community Garden and the Moffitt School Greenhouse Project. There will be knowledgeable speakers and vendor booths that focus on sustainability, education, seeds, local handmade products, and permaculture. You'll meet wonderful people, make valuable connections, and create relationships with like-minded and common goal-oriented people. In addition, the San Luis Valley Seed Exchange is excited to announce their inaugural harvest celebration in October, which will also be held at the Event Center at Joyful Journey Hot Springs Spa, and will focus on end-of-the-season gardening, including harvesting, preserving, and seed saving. More details to come. As a sponsor, your business or organization helps fund the event expenses, including space rentals, advertising, and donations. In gratitude, your business will be promoted in various ways, including being linked on the podcast page, the SLV Seed Exchange website, event program, posters, banners, and more. With all the benefits of being a sponsor, you'll want to reach out soon to the friendly folks at Joyful Journey so they can provide you with sponsor benefit information. Be sure and tell your friends and associates about this tremendous sponsorship opportunity. Learn more through the Seed Exchange website, SLVSeedExchange.com. That's SLVSeedExchange.com. Or call Joyful Journey Hot Springs at 719-256-4328. That's 719-256-4328. Or for more information, email Joyful Journey at marketing@jjhotsprings.com. That's marketing@jjhotsprings.com. The 10th annual SOV Seed Exchange, hosted by Joyful Journey Hot Springs Spa on Saturday, March 7th. Proud sponsor of this second installment of the Mysterious San Luis Valley podcast with paranormal researcher Christopher O'Brien.
We appreciate you telling your friends to listen to the podcast on slvoices.com and check out our extensive calendar of events, more listings in one location than any other website around. You can help spread the word, too, by joining our Facebook group, SL Voices, Your Voice in the San Luis Valley, and liking our posts on other social media outlets. Also, check out our Instagram page for behind-the-scenes looks at what we do. And please, patronize our local sponsors. Remember to support the businesses here in the Valley. Most are owned and operated by your friends, family, and neighbors. We all love this area and want to see it flourish. And you can help by buying and supporting locally in your own and surrounding communities. Check back for another local podcast soon. Until then, this has been San Luis Valley Voices, a production of SL Voices, your voice in the San Luis Valley.